Welcome to For the Long Run, the podcast exploring the why behind what keeps runners running long, strong, and motivated. I'm your host, Jonathan Levitt. Through personal and professional connections in the running world, I have the privilege of getting to know some amazing athletes. I've always been fascinated by the psychological aspect of running, and this podcast is aimed at exploring this and much more. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Beat Elite. I was introduced to Beat Elite by Amelia Boone ahead of the Spartan World Championships in Tahoe in 2017 due to the benefit of Beats when at altitude. I had been looking for a Beat product that had a good taste and have loved Beat Elite's powder mix ever since. Beats can enhance muscle efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise, essentially making it easier to work harder. Talk about being efficient. They've even done a clinical trial on their product with interval training in cyclists and found an 18% increase in potential duration. Try Beat Elite yourself to experience the benefits of Beat-powered performance. Take 20% off all Beat Elite products at humann.com/beatelite. That's human with an extra n.com/beatelite with the code FTLR. Welcome back. Today I have Megan Slavin joining the podcast. Megan, thanks so much for taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So first question, who is Megan?
I'm Megan and I live in North Phoenix. I'm a physical therapist and I currently am the clinic director at a outpatient facility in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I got into trail running about 6 years ago, but I didn't really have much of a running background. I grew up as a competitive gymnast and then ran my first mile when I was 18 with my dad.
That's awesome. And you've done some pretty incredible things in the few years that you have been running.
Yeah.
So we were connected in probably 2017 by Magda Boulay. I think you saw an Instagram post from her, learned about Inside Tracker, came to us, and we connected and then met in person at Western States that following summer. So it's sort of the perfect example of how cool social media can be. You can become friendly with somebody through social media and then actually meet them in person.
Yes, definitely. Yep, that is exactly what happened. We saw a couple of athletes that used Inside Tracker and became really interested in trying it. My husband Brian and I. And then, yeah, that's exactly what happened. We became friends on social media, and then we were out at Western States crewing and pacing for my friend John in 2018. So that is when we met.
And so you were crewing that year, but you ran the next year, right?
Yes. So kind of crazy, like not super common, but I'm very grateful. I got to crew and pace. And I just remember being at mile 55 at Michigan Bluff and asking a bunch of the runners' crews how long their runner, like how many years it had taken them to get into Western States. And most of them were telling me it was about 6 or 7 tries. And so I just kind of decided in that moment that I was, you know, ready to do Western States whenever I got drawn and that I wasn't going to obsess about it because I couldn't control the lottery. And just, it was gaining popularity. And so, it was getting more and more challenging to get in. And so it was just pretty crazy to, on my third try, get drawn. And so I got to go back a year later where everything was just kind of fresh. So I had been to the training camp and then, crewing and then getting to pace, my friend to the finish line. I learned a lot about Western States and just was so excited that I was going to have the opportunity to do it.
What was pacing to the finish line like?
It was one of the coolest experiences. You know, you watch a lot of documentaries, you see a lot of film on people doing that race, and it is so prestigious and it's kind of every trail runner's dream. But to see your friend that you train like mile for mile with get to Auburn, it was pretty emotional, but so awesome. Like everyone says that the atmosphere there is electric. And that is like an understatement. Like the energy there is just beyond amazing. And to see your friend cross the finish line and help him get there is one of the most rewarding things.
And where did you pick him up? Like mile 80?
No, I actually just did the last 6 miles. So Western States is kind of funny. Yeah. You can get a pacer at mile 62 and then you can get another pacer at 80 and then you can get a pacer with the last six to go. And so, my friend John, he wanted me and then my friend Brad and Susie to pace him. And so that's just kind of how it ends up. It's not like evenly split, but, I was just so happy to be there. So 6 miles, 1 mile, however many miles, like I was just super excited to be able to, help him get to the finish line. And that was his fourth 100-mile finish. And I'd helped him to, the finish of all his 100-milers. So it was pretty amazing.
Could you imagine that you would be running it the next year? Like, was that something you were thinking about?
I mean, like I decided that day, I was just like, I really want to do this race. But I kind of was okay with the fact that, hey, it could be 10 years from now, but when it's my time, it'll be my time and I'll get drawn and I will train so hard to be able to finish the race and do it. So I think it was pretty crazy to get drawn the following year, but, yeah, it was amazing.
And so that was your second 100-miler?
That was actually my third. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. I had done Javelina 100 in 2017 and then I did Stagecoach 100 in 2018 and then Western States in 2019.
Got it. Javelina is quite a party, isn't it?
Yes. If you've never been there, you should definitely check it out. It's a very large event and it's gotten really big. Each year I'm just blown away by, you know, how it's taken to the next level. It's quite an experience. I think it's a really great first 100-miler if you are looking at getting into the 100-mile distance, just because you do five loops. It's challenging because you come back through and see your crew or your family. The start finish area is kind of like one big giant party, but you are kind of crisscrossing with runners all day. So you're never by yourself. People are dressed up in Halloween costumes and it's just a really fun time.
And what is it about the 100-mile distance that you seem to enjoy?
You know, I was super surprised that I love that distance so much. I just remember Javelina was kind of, it's a long day and you're out there and you're kind of thinking about at mile 20, like, oh my gosh, I have to do four more of these loops. And, you know, it can get a little bit daunting when you think about it mentally like that. But 100-mile races are very similar to just how my daily like work day is. It's like you have to think about what you're currently doing, but you also have to have an idea of what's coming down the road. So I'm a physical therapist and every day I see my schedule and very rarely does my schedule end up going the way that it's set out. And so I kind of felt like 100 miles was life in a day. There's going to be some easy, really effortless moments. And then there's going to be some challenges and some, curveballs that get thrown your way, but you've just got to kind of adapt and roll with it and just kind of get through it, but have an idea of what's coming, but really focus on the moment you're in. So I just liked that aspect of it. And I don't know, running long it's crazy. Like you start out and you know, your watch maybe beeps at 1 mile and it's like, okay, 99 more miles to go. Yeah. But it is so crazy how time flies and where your feet can take you and how far you can go.
For sure. So you've been running for, you know, less than 10 years and you've found your way to the front of many races. You've won a handful of races and you've been top 10 overall in a handful of them. What's that trajectory like? When did you realize, you know, this was something you're pretty talented at and did you ever think you'd be, you know, front running like that?
No, not at all. I think that it took a root, like surrounding myself with a really great group of people. When we started trail running, it was, you know, we went out on a 3-mile trail run and it was pretty scary. Like I was scared of, you know, snakes and rocks and I just didn't really know what to expect, but we joined a trail running group that had just been formed called AZ Trail Leggers. And we would just meet every Sunday. And that was like the best day of the week. Like I looked forward to going for a run and seeing Arizona in a way I had never seen it before. And so for me, it just started like I had done a few half marathons in the past and I had done some road running. I did one marathon and I didn't really enjoy running in that way. I always had to listen to music. I felt like I always felt sick. Like it was just really challenging for me. And then my dad was a marathon runner. So to just hear what his times were and the look where I was at, I just didn't really feel like I was a talented runner. I just kind of felt like, you know, this is something that's fun and I just want to try to stay in shape. And I would sign up for races with my friends, but it was when I got into the trails where I didn't need music anymore. I didn't really care about, like, you kind of throw pace out the window. I feel like when you're on the trails, there's so much variety. The views are unreal. And, you know, I fell in love with it so much that we started to volunteer and crew and pace at these events. And I think that just gave me the motivation to kind of, you know, start with the smaller distances and slowly work my way up from there. But it took a long time for my friends to convince me to, you know, try a 50K. And then once I tried that, it was, you know, people trying to convince me to try a 50 miler. And they were always saying like, you know, Megan, I feel like you're meant for the long run, but I didn't really believe them. And then it's just like slowly I gained that confidence to try because I was running, you know, step for step with some of these people that had done multiple 100-mile races, but I just felt like I'm not ready for something like this. And so I think to get to that moment where you do sign up for it, like it's pretty cool. Like to get to that point where you're just like, yeah, like I'm going to try this and I don't know what's going to happen. And I just, when I did have Alina, I told my family it would probably take me like 27 to 30 hours. And I just remember my sister text my husband, Brian, and said, hey, when do you think she's going to finish? Like, we want to come out to the finish line. And he's like, oh, she finished a few hours ago. And it was just like I didn't plan for that. Like, I just kind of said, you know, my number one goal is to finish, but if I can finish under 24 hours, that would be amazing. But I didn't want to go into my first 100 miler with a time goal. I think that sometimes we set these goals and even if we come in like 5 minutes after what that time goal is, it can really like give you, like, I don't want my first moment when I cross the finish line to be a negative one. Like I want to be so proud of the journey and getting to the finish line that I don't want a time to tell me like I did a good job or I didn't do a good job. So I feel like that was the best approach for my first 100 miler. And yeah, like I don't know. It was crazy to land in the top 10 of that race just because it is a bigger race. But yeah, it just kind of gave me the motivation to keep trying. Like I wanna do these longer races and I wanna try to be as competitive as I can and I wanna continue to get better and faster and stronger. And it's something that you know, I don't really know what my end goal is. I just wanna continue this journey and see where it will take me.
I love that. One of the pieces of uncertainty that you've not addressed, but went for recently is an FKT attempt. And my 13-year-old self is going to come out and say it's the funniest FKT name possible. Hole to hump.
Yes, I've got so that. Talk a lot. To me about
talk to me about hole to hump. Where did that come from?
So it was quite a while ago, but it was 1982. There's a man named Scott Baxter who he ran from the bottom of the Grand Canyon and came out of the canyon, ran to Flagstaff, Arizona, and then climbed to the top of Humphreys Peak, which is the tallest point in Arizona. And that's at 12,633 feet. So he went from the Colorado River, that was 2,500 feet, and then he got himself all the way to Humphreys Peak. And so that's kind of how that name originated, because you're starting from the hole in the ground, and then you're climbing to Humphreys Peak. But it's actually pretty fascinating that this started as a route that actually went the opposite direction. And I don't think there's anybody out there that has, at least not on the FKT website yet, but who's done the opposite direction. So going from the top of Humphreys all the way down into the canyon. But yeah, so that's kind of how it started. And then there was a man, the following year, Mike Ellerman, who, beat his time by like 30 minutes. And then there's been a handful of people that have done it along the way. But my coach, James Bonet, he was supposed to do Hard Rock last year and it was canceled. So he went out and he had all this, you know, fitness from training for that race that he had, had his eyes on setting an FKT. So he went out and set the fastest known time last year. And then this year, he was helping me train for San Diego 100. And then, obviously a lot of races got canceled due to, COVID-19. So we continued the training block and he just kind of planted that seed like, hey, maybe we should try an FKT attempt or do some long adventure runs. Like you've been, you know, putting in these high mileage weeks and doing these back-to-back long runs and let's just kind of see where it goes from here. And so things were closed because of, COVID. So the Grand Canyon wasn't even open at this point, and we hadn't even talked about trying Hold a Hump. It was more of, you know, maybe trying an FKT in Prescott, Arizona, or trying one in Flagstaff. And then, he just, you know, randomly texted me one day and said, hey, I think with, you know, how your training's been going, it would be cool if you tried this. And at the time, we thought that other women had, you know, successfully completed it. I had heard about it, but I didn't know kind of the history and how many women had tried and how many had finished. And when we looked it up, we saw that it was open. So there hadn't been a woman to successfully finish it yet. And so that's when I decided that was what I wanted to try. So we went for it. And so the beginning of June, we decided to drop into the Grand Canyon and go all the way to Humphreys Peak.
Okay. So I've driven that and that's a long drive.
Yes.
talk to me about, first of all, okay. And getting into the canyon is fairly punishing as well. So I'm sort of nerding out here on the logistics. How did you sleep in the canyon? Did you walk it down in the morning? How did it work?
Yeah. So I had read a lot about how some people would hike down and sleep. And then what James had done, he hiked down kind of at night and then he slept for like 3 hours at the bottom. And then he started to come out at like 1:30 or 2 in the morning. And so he did the majority of his running was kind of coming out early morning and then running during the day. And then he got to the top of Humphreys Peak, you know, later that afternoon. But when talking to him about how to go about this, the thing that's challenging is it gets really hot in the canyon in the summer. It holds a lot of heat. And so even 85 degrees.
Really, really hot being like 110, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. but even if it's like 85 degrees, it's just like the heat is like radiating off of these rocks and it just feels so much hotter than it really is. But then the flip side is that in Flagstaff, there are monsoons and they hit almost like every day in the afternoon. And so timing that where you're not going to have to deal with thunder and lightning and just, you know, rain and hail and stuff like that. It's like really hard to time this properly. So it was a very small window, I think, to safely attempt this. And we didn't even know till like 2 weeks before that it was a go. Cause we were just like waiting to see if the Grand Canyon was even going to be open. So I just picked his brain and said, you know, what do you think? Like, should I go to the bottom and stay for a while? Like, what do you recommend? And he basically just gave me insight on, hey, like if I did this again, I would not hang out at the bottom for that long. Like it gets pretty hot. And even if it's at night, like the canyon holds that heat and you're just going to lay there and be dehydrated. So he came up with the idea of hiking down in the middle of the afternoon and then just taking a little bit of time at the bottom to, you know, cool down and fuel and fill up water and then kind of head out. So I think he timed it like absolutely perfect. My friend Bill and I, we started hiking down into the canyon. It was probably about 12:30 in the afternoon. And we got to the bottom. It was probably almost 3 o'clock. And then we just took 30 minutes. So we sat in the Colorado River and cooled down. We brought a filter down there, filled up with water, ate, just kind of took our time, and then started this whole journey at about 3:30 in the afternoon.
How long, and which trail did you take to get out?
So we actually did the New Hance Trail, which I'd never done before. There have been a lot of people to do this route and then also attempt this route that will go down South Kaibab and they'll come back up South Kaibab. But this is an open FKT. So that just means that you have to get to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and start at the Colorado River. And then your time starts as you start to make that climb out of the canyon.
It's like a choose your own adventure.
Exactly. Just get there. So James had done the New Hance Trail the year before. And so that's the route that I took, and it kind of pops you out further east. So then you don't have to run on the rim road as long. And then you can make your trek towards Flagstaff.
Do you know how long it took you to go from the Colorado River to the top of the canyon?
Yeah, we started at 3:30 and I believe it was maybe like 5:51 when I got out of the canyon. So it was, the whole like getting down to the bottom, taking a little bit of a break and coming up was, yeah, it was a little bit under 6 hours, I believe. So maybe I just said that timing wrong, but that whole portion was like 5 hours and 51 minutes. Cause I remember James said, yeah, it'll probably take you to about 6 hours. And we were about 9 minutes under what he was projecting. So,
wow. So for context, it took me probably 4 hours to go up the 6.5 miles of South Kaibab. So that's incredible. the round trip took about the same amount of time. And that was like, I had nothing left in the tank, but I had also, you know, run 35 miles prior. But to do that at the start of the run. Okay. So the run from the top of the Grand Canyon to Flagstaff, or the distance, is about a 90 minute drive. So how long did that portion take you running? And I know in one of the articles about this, you said that it's like a soul sucking experience there.
Yes. So I think a lot of people, when they prepare for this, they think a lot about the climb out of the canyon. And then they think a lot about the climb up Humphreys, but that section in between kind of eats you alive because it looks so easy on paper and you just think like, yeah, I'm going to fly. Like I'm going to get to the top and I'm just going to cruise and it's going to be awesome. Then I'm going to get to Flagstaff and I'll just hike again. But James had told me that, he went too fast when he came out of the canyon. So he said he had gotten sick a little bit and he just, you know, was running like some 7.5 minute miles. And it was just like way too quick. So he had given me that advice to just kind of take it pretty chill and, not overdo it in those miles. And that when I got to mile 35, that 35 to 65 was going to kind of be this uphill pitch that it looks flat, but it goes just enough uphill that it's kind of challenging to run. So he had me do like a treadmill run a few weeks before, like a 2% grade for like 10 miles. And I thought it was like the most boring and difficult thing, but it was really good that he made me do stuff like that because it's not very stimulating, but it's just challenging because it's the same repetitive thing over and over again. And that's not really my strength. Like I'm better at like, you know, hitting a hard climb, getting to the top and then having some downhill or some flat to kind of like, you know, even things out. But my strength is definitely not the, you know, just that small pitch of going uphill the entire time. And then I had kind of run into a hard spot way earlier than I thought I would. I just had some major stomach issues at like basically like mile 16 to like 25. I just started to get sick and wasn't able to eat very much and didn't really know what was going on because I felt so strong in the canyon and I was so excited. And I honestly think out of the entire like hold a hump route, like I did really strong in the canyon. And then like I did bounce back here and there, but I would say the rest of it was, it was kind of a rough journey, but was definitely like so thankful to get it done.
Thanks again to Beat Elite for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. I have dialed in a combination of sports nutrition products that works very well for me, and Beat Elite has been a part of that for the last 3 years, particularly ahead of workouts, long runs, and whenever I'm headed to altitude. Don't just take my word for it. There's plenty of science on the performance benefits of Beats. Normally, it's hard to get these benefits in an enjoyable and convenient way, but Beat Elite has figured that part out too. Try it for yourself and take 20% off Beat Elite products with the code FTLR on their website, which is human.com/beatelite. I'll also link to it in the show notes. So mile 16, you feel a little off with all of this road and a giant mountain ahead of you. What are you thinking about?
In that moment, I couldn't believe it was happening that fast. And so I just tried to keep myself calm. And I think the hard thing about an FKT is that because it's not a race, like you think about in a race, you just got to get to that next aid station. And a lot of times you get to that aid station, and if you're having a rough time, like there is some volunteer there or someone that has this like magical remedy for you. Like they tell you to try something you've never tried before, and all of a sudden you kind of bounce back and feel better. But with an FKT attempt, you pack your car full of things that you think are going to work for you, and then all of a sudden your body starts rejecting everything in the car. So it's like there's no magical volunteer that's giving you this, you know, different approach to what you're doing to turn your day around. You've just got to kind of do it on your own. So I was a little nervous. I was kind of running like basically 4 miles at a time, and then the crew vehicle would be there. And I think looking back, I would like to spread that out more, like have the crew vehicle be like 8 miles away, but
bigger because intervals,
because my stomach just kept turning. It was good that they were so close, but it was also easy to kind of get to them and then like take a little break. And then, so I think that definitely slowed me down. But when I got to mile 25, like I had been puking, and that is when, James kind of rolled up to where we were at. And he told me, he's like, this is the same section that I was throwing up in last year. And he's like, how do your legs feel? And I told him, you know, my legs feel pretty good. It's just, I can't get my stomach under control. And he's just like, well, just keep moving your legs. So if you've got to walk, and then you can maybe start jogging, and then you'll kind of start running. And he's like, just think about all those back-to-back long runs you did. Like you're going to bounce back. So, my husband, Brian, jumped in and ran about 4 miles with me. And then James jumped in and ran 6 miles with me. And then my friend Bill jumped in and ran 10 miles with me. So all of a sudden now I've gone 20 miles when at mile 25, I'm staring at my watch and I'm like, I don't know if I have 45 miles left in me to feel like this and to get something like this done. So I kind of turned a pretty big corner then, and thought that when the sun came up that I would get this second wind and that I would have all this energy and that the sun, it was going to be a new day and I was going to feel great. And then all of a sudden when the sun came up, it started to get very windy and very cold and just like super frustrating. Like that road, the highway coming into Flag, it's kind of like, you know, just a big hill.
Straight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's just funny. And we do that in races, I think too, where we focus on kind of the hard parts, and that sometimes a part where we think we're going to do really well and excel is sometimes the most challenging. And I definitely think that's what happened to me. I thought I was going to get to that road and cruise, and it was really challenging. I remember running like 3 miles of it, and then Brian drove by and I thought I just had 3 more miles of the road to go, but he's like, yeah, you just have another like 4.5 or 5 miles. And it just like devastated me. I'm like, no, it's been 3 miles. And he's like, I don't know what to tell you. Yeah. And so he's just like staring at me and he's just like, I don't know what to tell you, but it's like, I just drove it and it's 5 more miles. And so I think that was like kind of hit me pretty hard. And I took a little bit of a break there, but, you know, then he kind of kicked me out and said, all right, you just got to get to them. And then you'll go up the dirt road for 5 miles. And then we get to go up Humphrey. So it was like, we had to just kind of break it down into sections, to get it accomplished.
So you start at 2,500 feet, you climb out of the canyon at
around 7,000. Yeah.
And then flag is what, 7. So then you've got 5,500 feet to climb.
Yeah.
And so how many miles was it from the bottom of Humphreys to the top?
That is about like 4.5 or 5 miles, depending on the route you take. Yeah. So if you go straight up the trail, it is 5. We did a little bit of the ski slope and then cut over onto the trail. So that cut out about 1/2 mile of it. But that was like really, that was a steep, it felt like the steepest thing I'd ever done. And I think it's just cause I was just mentally and physically done, that it was pretty challenging. So, but I did, so Nick Curry, he set the FKT the same day and he ended up going on to the trail, and he felt like that cost him about 30 minutes just because there's a lot of roots that you've got to step over and big rocks that you got to climb up. And when you're that late into the game, it's just, it's very challenging.
So what was that experience like? What was it like knowing that you were, you know, one sunrise in and one mountain to go? What, you know, standing at the bottom or running at the bottom of it, where was your head there?
I don't know where my head exactly was at. I just know that my friends were telling me like, hey, it looks like it's pretty cold at the top. Like at that point they had told me that it was pretty windy, which I could feel the wind, but they said it was pretty windy and then it was going to be like in the high 20s, low 30s, like the temperature at the top. And it's like, I'm coming from the valley where it's like 100 degrees. So for me, that is like ridiculously cold. and so I just remember getting to the dirt road and we were, you know, almost to the base of Humphreys and everyone's just like, do you want to change? Like, it's going to be pretty cold up there. And I was just like, no, like, I don't want to waste any time. My friend Matt ended up coming to the summit with us and he had grabbed like my North Face, like puffy jacket and put it in his backpack. And that was like so clutch because it definitely exactly what everyone told me. It got very cold. And, I think that was really good that he had my jacket and that I was able to kind of stay as warm as I could. But yeah.
So the finish of this is a fascinating mind fuck, right? You're at the top of a mountain. It's 12:05 and you're not done yet. So but I think it's like the perfect epitome for anything. Like, you finish something, that's not the end of the road, right? You're really like just getting started on whatever the next adventure is. So with this, you literally had, you know, another adventure. You had to get down and back to Flagstaff. So how did you feel when you finished, and had you even thought about the fact that you still had to get down?
No, like my mind was not thinking about the way down at all. We were concentrating on the top, and there was one point where the gusts of wind were so bad that Brian turned around and just said, you know, I don't know if we're going to make it to the top. Because there was like 80 to 100 mile an hour gusts of wind, and there was like 60 mile an hour winds when we got above tree line. So all these people coming down from the summit were basically telling us to turn around. And so to get that close and to feel like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to stop, you know, a mile short of what I accomplish, like of what I want to accomplish, was kind of devastating. And so I knew when we got to the saddle, Brian kind of stopped and he turned around to look at me, and I just didn't want to even give him the opportunity to like plant that seed in my head. So I just looked at him and then I just kind of kept moving, and he was like, okay, like, you want to do this, like, game on, we're going to get this accomplished. But it took us over an hour to do that last mile, just with having, you know, at that point, almost 80 miles on your legs. And then to have, these gusts of wind, you know, hitting you. I had got, you know, the wind like threw me into a boulder. I have like this nice little scar on my shin. Like, it was just like, it was crazy. We're hugging boulders, we're crab walking, just doing everything we can to get to the top. And then, our friend Darren, he was coming down and he told me, he said, it's very difficult, but you can do it. And he just kind of gave us some tips on how to climb to the top. And so that's what we did. We took his advice and we got to the top, and probably hung out for about 3 minutes at the top, took our picture, turned the watch off, like did everything we needed to do to make this official, and then started our trek down. And I felt fine for like the first mile coming down, just because you're trying to get out of the wind and you're moving with a purpose. And then once we got below tree line, there was a sunny spot, and we just decided like, hey, let's sit down for a tiny little bit and like grab a bite to eat. And so, you know, I think I ate a bite of like a peanut butter sandwich or something, and we're sitting there and we're talking about it and everything's fine. And then the second we stood up to start coming down, that is when it hit me. And I was just like, oh my gosh, we have 3.5 miles like to get to the bottom. This is going to take forever. And I was just like tripping left and right, you know, over every root and every rock. And, you know, I'm just watching my friend Matt and watching Brian just kind of cruise down. And I just felt like I was in slow motion and, you know, just could not wait to get to the bottom. And I pretty much got into the car and we were driving Matt back to his truck, and I had like, I fell asleep like instantly. So,
wow.
It was challenging, but, yeah, it was a long journey.
That's incredible. Did you have any issues with the altitude at 12,000 feet, or were you just not up there for that long?
We weren't up there for that long, but I think Humphreys Peak has always been this mountain that has been pretty challenging for me. I have struggled with altitude, and I've been sick many times on that mountain. And I kind of felt like similar, like just not 100% with it and just kind of feeling sort of sick, but, just kept like powering on. And so I didn't feel like it was too big of an issue, but I did feel like when I came out of the canyon and I was at, you know, a little over 7,000 feet and then running on the rim road, there was a moment where I just felt like, you know, my legs felt a little bit heavier than I felt like they should have. And I just, my friend Bill told me, he's like, the altitude's probably hitting us a little bit right now. Cause you know, we live in Phoenix. We did stay at, altitude. We stayed in, Flagstaff the night before, and then we drove up to the canyon. And so it was like, your body's kind of going through a lot, you know, like I live at like 1500 feet and then stayed at, you know, 7,000 feet. And then I dropped down to 2,500. So it's kind of a lot of up and down. But I think I handled it, better than I have in the past, but I definitely do feel like it was a challenge.
Awesome. And how are the legs feeling a couple of weeks later?
Oh, they're feeling pretty good. I was kind of joking around with my friends and saying like, yeah, when you kind of have to hike the last 15 miles of this, because I didn't have much running in me like towards the end. And so I felt like it made my recovery a little bit quicker, because it's not like I was running super hard at the end. I was just kind of doing everything I could to get through it. So I took a week off of running and then felt fine once I went back to it.
Why'd you do it?
I think that, you know, I was training for San Diego 100, and this is a really challenging time for everybody. Like, I think everybody's dealing with hardships left and right. Whether that's losing their job or being sick, or maybe someone in your family is sick. And there's a lot of really negative, you know, I don't want to say like kind of terrible things going on. And so I feel like once San Diego 100 was canceled, I turned a corner, which is kind of crazy, but I continued on with this training block, and I had really crazy hours at work, and my schedule was a lot more demanding than it had been, just because my staff was a lot lighter than it had been. And I was still able to get out there and put in the highest mileage weeks that I ever had, like in my life. And so I feel like that showed me that, you know, I do have these obstacles, and there are these things that it would be okay. It would be okay if I said, you know, I'm too busy, or I can't do this, I can't get to it. But running was kind of helping me deal with everything that was going on. And I didn't want to let, like, I didn't know where things were headed. Like, you know, I couldn't control what was going on at work, what was going on in the world, but I could control that, you know, I want to continue this training block, and I want to run because this is something that I'm passionate about and something that I love. And that if I can get through this, like if I can get through these high mileage weeks on weeks where like I'm working 60 hours, I think that's going to help me not just now, but years from now. So maybe years down the road, when things normalize a little bit and maybe there's, you know, a long race, I can come back to this moment and remember that I was able to push through some pretty hard times and still do something epic in the process. And so when my coach came to me and said, you know, I feel like you have it in you to go for an FKT, I just thought, wow, this is amazing. This isn't something that I ever envisioned in my entire life. And to see that there was no woman that had ever finished it, I kind of told myself, like, hey, even if you take forever to do this and your time's not very fast, which I spent many days kind of being sad about my time, like it wasn't as fast as I thought it would be, but I don't think it matters. Like, I think to just be able to be the first woman to do something like this and to help maybe pave the way and plant that seed for other women to get out there and try is such an amazing thing. And is so rewarding to me that, like, I would love to help other people be able to do something like this. So if I can get through it and show people that during a hard time, you can still go after your goals, then, you know, I think that's like the most amazing, amazing feeling.
Yeah, I love that. It's similar to a conversation I had on the podcast with Corey Waltering, where he started his own FKT attempt on the Ice Age Trail, right as the George Floyd protests were starting to happen. And I asked him, I was like, why now? Why are you doing this now? And his answer was, to tell a good story at a time when people need uplifting and motivation and this and that. And I think the parallel here is perfect. It's, you know, doing something hard to prove that we can do hard things and that we can get through hard things. And I was thinking about this. I was listening to my coach's podcast, David Roche, and he was talking about the same thing. Like, struggle is a part of being human and everybody struggles. But the important thing is what happens after that struggle. And the parallels between exactly what you shared in running, committing to do something that's hard, that, you know, has unknowns and things that you thought would be easy actually are difficult. The parallel to life is perfect. And if you can get through it on the one side, you can get through it on the other side.
Yes, definitely. I love that. Like, there have been some really amazing stories, and, you know, a lot of people are out there they have a lot of training under their belt. And so they're going for these, you know, FKTs or just amazing things. And I just think it's really inspiring. And it just shows us that we can get through these hard times and still achieve, you know, big and great things. And nothing's really handed to us. Things don't come easy, but, and that's like part of why I love trail running. Like, I do think that trail running to me is like the perfect metaphor for life, that there are some smooth and effortless moments where you could just go on forever. And there are some very like rocky, crazy uphill battles. And, you know, you kind of got your head down and it's just like, you don't think you can take another step. But if you just keep moving forward and you can handle those challenges that are being thrown your way, like, you're going to get to the top of the mountain. And when you get there, you can turn around and you can look at the trail that you took to get there. And it will just help remind you of everything you endured to get there. And I think about that almost on every single run, like every mountain I climb. It's, you know, you're going through these hard moments and you don't think you're going to get to the top, but if you can just stick with it, like, you're going to get there.
I love that so much. And it's exactly a reflection that I had when I finished the canyon back in the fall. And the coolest thing about the canyon and I guess mountains in general is you can see where you came from. And when you're standing at the top of the South Rim, you can see the North Rim, and you can see how far of an effort it was. And, you know, maybe it's only 18 miles away, 17 miles away, but, you know, by the way you travel and whatnot, you know, it's 20 plus. And it's such a feeling to be able to literally retrace your steps or look back on all those switchbacks and have that conscious thought of like, holy shit, it was so hard right there. And, oh, that part was easy. Oh, I felt like a million bucks there. And, you know, what if I only knew what was up ahead? And again, it's that feeling that you can, I vividly remember climbing out of the canyon and being in the worst mental state I've ever been in, with no option but to keep moving forward. Like you said, mm-hmm. there's nothing you can do besides taking a very expensive helicopter ride out. yeah. It will get you out. And just like in life, there are times when there's nothing that you can do besides keep moving forward. And I think sport, particularly endurance sport, is a perfect analogy and perfect metaphor for life in general.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
So, switching gears a little bit, what are you scared of?
What am I scared of? I would say one of my biggest fears, and I just think this is like one of my biggest fears that I've like always had, is just, falling short, like setting a goal and just, you know, falling so short of that and like maybe upsetting others in the process. And it's something I've gotten better at, but I grew up as a gymnast. And so you're just always striving for perfection. And so part of that helps mold you into a very driven and determined person, but sometimes that can kind of be the downfall too. So I guess I do get scared sometimes, like, oh, am I going to set this really crazy hard goal down the road and just fall so completely short that it was just like, why did I even try in the first place? But I try to stay in the moment and know that failure is something, I mean, I've failed at many things. I have fallen short many times. It's not the greatest feeling, but I think that it can help kind of spark that flame to get out there and try harder or to not give up. And so it's kind of like, to answer your question, I feel like one of my biggest fears is also, I can kind of turn that into like the fuel for, you know, becoming stronger in the process for whatever it is, whatever the goal is.
Yeah. I think failure is only failure if you don't learn from it. And part of the process is putting yourself out there and shooting your shot and coming up short. And I think that if you don't fail, you're not trying hard enough. And if you succeed at everything you do and everybody loves you, you might want to take more risks.
Yeah. That is a very good way of putting it. Cause I think that I can be really hard on myself. And, you know, my husband's always telling me like, Megan, things are not always going to be perfect. Or, you know, we were talking with a runner the other day when we were up in Colorado, and, you know, I look at him and he wins almost every race that he enters. And I'm like, man, I just want to be on that level where I could just like race and perform the way that I train. And, you know, to hear someone like that say, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes in the process and I've had to do a lot of trial and error, and it's taken me a long time to get where I am now. And, you know, you've only been in this sport for this many years. And so you've just got to kind of find your groove, and things are going to, you know, get better, but things could get worse too. And you just have to, if you walk away from every experience with, you know, a positive, and then maybe one or two things that you can focus on to get better at down the road, then, you know, you're going to continue to learn and grow and be better for it. So I think that's really, really a good thing, is to hear kind of the background of where people are at. Cause sometimes we look at someone, we look at them on social media, or we look at them on Ultra Sign Up, and it's like, man, they win every single race that they're in, or they crush every single, you know, everything that they do. But, you know, that's not really the reality. I think that, you know, there was a road, there was a something that person had to go through to get them to where they are now. And that's something I need to be better at, is just learning that, you know, we don't just start at the top of the mountain, right? Like, we've got to climb to get there.
And then sometimes you have to go back down.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes you got to go all the way back down to your car.
what do you wish you knew when you started trail running that you know today?
I mean, part of me just wishes I knew about trail running in general way
earlier,
way before. Yeah. Like, I just remember even being in high school and, people would say I should, you know, do track or take up running. And it was just something that I always looked at as like running was almost like a punishment. Like when I was in gymnastics, like we ran for conditioning, you know, or you run down the vault runway or you run into your tunneling pass, but it wasn't something that you do. And so I guess I just wish I knew more about the sport. Like I watched my dad train really hard. He did a lot of marathons, and I just knew that he was so passionate and had this love for running. And there's six kids in my family, so he was always there for us. But he was carving out, you know, time to get his running in because that was something that made him feel good. And so I guess just having that now, like having that connection with running now, like I just wish that I found it earlier. But I think in terms of trail running, you know, I learn a lot from the people, like not necessarily like my own races, but I learn a lot from other people's races. And so I just think that I want to continue, you know, volunteering and being on the sidelines and being there for my husband and my friends and, you know, helping them with their journey. Like, I think I always take something away from those moments that can help me with mine. And so I think I'm learning every day and every race I go to, whether it's my race or someone else's, there's something I can take away from that to help me hopefully be better.
That's awesome. If we want to follow along with your journey, where can we find you?
So on Instagram, my Instagram is Meg Slavin, and that's pretty much like the best way to find me. And then on Facebook, I'm under Megan McGuire Slavin.
Awesome. Well, I hope to see you at some point, either in Arizona or Tahoe or somewhere in the mountains sometime soon.
Yes, somewhere in the mountains. I will see you in the mountains. Yes.
Yes.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for the chat today.
Thank you so much.
Of course. That's it for today's episode. Like many long runs, it's sad when it has to end. I hope you join in next week on For the Long Run. And in the meantime, happy trails. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would mean a lot to me if you shared it so that others can find it and enjoy it too.